Welcome everybody to Praxis Audio Conference Training on Safety and Accountability Audits for Grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Casey McGee and I'll be your host for today's call. Today is part five, the last in our series. Today we'll hear from Jane Sebesky about data collection and analysis and how you do that during an audit. Three housekeeping details that I think probably all of you have heard before, but just for the record, I'm going to leave all the lines open during the presentation and if you happen to have background noise in your office, you can press star 6 on your keypad to mute your line and then star 6 on your keypad to unmute yourself again when you'd like to speak. When you are speaking, please remember to say your name and the state you're calling from so we can identify you. And lastly, a reminder that we do record these calls. We make them available for $8 a CD. The order form will be up on our website after the series is over. So, Jane, if you'd like to go ahead and start, welcome.
Thanks, and hello to everyone who's on the phone this afternoon. Our topic, as Casey said, is data collection and analysis, and we have a couple of broad areas that we want to cover in taking a look at how this all fits into the safety and accountability audit. I'll spend a little time doing an overview of the main ways of collecting data during a safety audit, and those are primarily interviews, observations, and something we call text analysis or case file review. Sometimes we sort of flip those words around a little bit interchangeably. But basically looking at the kind of documents and official representation of the work that gets done. And then the second broad area is to look a bit at debriefing and drawing conclusions. How do you do that, and also how do you do that in a way that minimizes defensiveness and produces the most productive and useful kind of conclusions that you can work with? And I was telling Casey earlier that in getting ready for this, I had a lot of fun doing it because I was thinking back on different safety audits that I've been involved with Praxis over the years and different communities around the country, and thinking about all of the wonderful community problem solving and analysis and contributions that different communities made to their overall coordinated community response. But then I also started thinking about the very first safety audit I was involved in, which is the same one I believe that Casey was primarily involved in, or at least I recall us both being there, and it was about 7 years ago, and it was a data collection whirlwind. It was what come to be known as an audit blitz. In other words, diving in, gathering everything all at one time, running back and forth. This was in the city of Knoxville, from one side of Knoxville to the other, going on ride-alongs at all hours of the day and night. And I think we've gotten a bit smarter about some of this, and wouldn't ordinarily perhaps send everybody out on a four-hour ride-along and then come back a few hours later and dive into text analysis in quite the same way. But the kind of nuts and bolts of gathering information are those three different things I mentioned earlier: interviews, observations, and text analysis. And if you think of kind of connecting those and drawing one of those, I think they're called Venn diagrams, and I have absolutely no idea why that is, but think of the interconnection and the support and the ways in which one informs the other. You cannot do this kind of inquiry and asking questions about our work without the ways in which talking with people, those interviews, help inform observations or the ways of looking at work day-to-day in its setting and what the context is for what 911 officers, dispatchers, police officers, visitation monitors, clerks of court, advocates, whomever is within the scope of your audit, being able to both talk with them, watch the work that they do, and then in turn, all of that informing this look at the text or at the documents and the official representation of the case and the steps in case processing. So, for example, one audit I can think of, the prosecutor in this small community was only when she was assigned to interview one of the police officers that she realized that the 911 service didn't actually come through the village, that it was operated by the Border Patrol, and had been operating on an assumption that, just as other municipalities in the county, that when an emergency call came in, it went to the county dispatch center and then to their local municipal police department. And in the course of this was that recognition of, this has a whole new level of complexity to what we're doing if we're now bringing in this federal agency into the picture who's actually taking calls and dispatching officers in our community. Another example of how this all kind of comes together are another community, and this I think has been a fairly common experience in many jurisdictions that start looking at criminal legal case processing. But this started with a focus group, and women in the focus group said, you know, we want to know why it is when there's an arrest been made, and the next thing we know, we're in the line at the grocery store or the drugstore, and he's right there. He's gotten out of jail, and we have no idea that was going to happen or when it was going to happen. And then in spending some time observing in the jail booking and release, one of the things that team members noticed was that there is a very quick turnaround between the point at which someone appears before the court commissioner or the judge and then is released. In talking with jail officers, found out that there was a procedure for notifying the advocacy program, who would then in turn notify victims about release from jail. But that typically happened almost simultaneously with someone appearing before the for their bail hearing and being released. And then in looking at the logs that established what was happening when, seeing that those calls to the advocates often took place within 2 or 3 minutes prior to release. So built into this whole system was the impossibility almost of providing timely notice of someone's release. So it's that interconnection of talking with people, seeing practitioners at work, and then reading a variety of documents related to how that case is accepted and constructed and all of the forms and notes and things that go into those files and records that we keep. So I want to step back a bit and talk a little bit about how do you even find this stuff in the first place? How do you locate the material to use in your data collection? And part of that comes with the audit coordinator's role in getting a sense of which agencies are within the scope of the audit, what kind of materials they use regularly, developing a sense of how a case moves through that particular system. If, for example, you were looking at doing an audit of protection order or restraining order practices, part of what an audit coordinator would do would be to get a sense of how that works. Where does somebody start that process? What kind of forms do they need? Who do they talk with in the clerk's office? Is there a protection order advocate? And get familiar with how that all works in bringing someone from I need a protection order to the point of a judicial decision maker saying, yes, here it is, or no, we're denying it. And then another piece comes in with the team and with the training and early debriefings. Team members, you all bring your own experience and perspectives on how a case moves through the civil or legal system, or what kind of work takes place within an advocacy organization if you're doing an internal audit, how things are put together if you're looking at supervised visitation and exchange. You have that kind of rich mix of people who know the job really well, of others who are coming with different perspectives, so can add that to the mix. And part of what you can do, both up front in preparing or training to do a safety audit and in the early debriefings, is always kind of being on the lookout. Oh, who do we want to talk with? What might we want to see? What sort of things do we want to read in this process? One example of a recent team training, and this was a community that was looking at 911 up to the point of release, booking and release from jail. So as part of the training, the audit team was together, and we kind of lined everybody up in the order in which they became involved in the case. So there was one of the team members was from 911. There was a patrol officer. There was an advocate who might be called to the scene. There were some hospital-based advocates and representatives of the domestic violence support programs at the hospital. And so we kind of laid out where people came in at which point, and then did a series of kind of group interviews, sort of starting off with 911. And what that helped us do was to lay out both those steps, sort of the, here's how, when a call is made, here's how it moves through the system. And then at each of those points, identifying, okay, who else do we want to interview here? Well, we want to interview the jail officer who's in charge of the orange card and has to do with notifying the shelter when the release is made. We want to observe what happens in those arraignment hearings. Who's there? How are victims contacted? Are they present or not? What kind of things do we want to read? Well, we want to read some 911 transcripts. We want to read patrol officers' reports. Oh, here's this other entity over here called Crime Victim Services that's got kind of a look at everything that's coming, and they see all of the police reports from all of the jurisdictions. So we certainly want to talk with them and maybe see how they do their work, and also how does the information they collect look and add to or help us learn more about the way in which that initial investigation and evidence and fact gathering takes place. So audit coordinators and team members have this kind of ongoing role of helping to identify where to look for the kind of interviews and observations and text or documents that the overall audit is going to take a look at. And before I forget, I want to mention there are several kinds of interviews within this umbrella of audit data collection. One are focus groups, both with communities and members and with practitioners, And where and how you conduct a focus group with someone is going to depend very much on the scope and focus of your audit. So, for example, if you are going to be taking a look, as I know one of the communities is, at some of their internal practices around their battery intervention program and crisis intervention, some of those focus groups then would take place with those who are using the battery intervention program, who have been sent there. It would be with women who have used crisis intervention services. And then thinking about maybe stepping out of that and looking at, is there a way we'd want to talk more generally with people in the community about how our services are understood? So, for example, you might think about doing a focus group, recruiting participants through maybe if there's some church groups or community groups or other avenues to reach a pool of women in the community and kind of find out, you know, here's a scenario. Here's this woman's experience. Who would she call? What kind of response do you think she'd get? Exploring how people see and understand those services as useful or available to someone in either themselves or someone else in the community. And then another area to look at would perhaps be focus groups with some of the other practitioners and points of contact that victims of battering have in the community. Might you look at talking with police or folks who work in the women infants nutrition program or public health nurses, getting that sense of how do you know about, understand, link people with our services. Now, you may not want to do any of that, but it gives you an example of some of the kinds of things you can think about in doing focus group interviews as part of a safety audit. Then the other three kind of interviews that are primarily more individual, one-on-one kind of interviews, are something that we've named the big picture. And it's just that. It's getting that big sweep of how is this all put together? How do we see the ways in which someone moves through the protection order or the custody system? What do we need to understand here about the overall administration, about the laws that go into it? What the authority is of decision makers and others who become involved in that case? And a lot of those are going to take place and be the responsibility of an audit coordinator. Not exclusively, but that's a piece of putting together that bigger understanding of the basic way that things work to then help identify the different kinds and points of data collection that you need to be thinking about. Then we have another kind of interview called the practitioner-based interview. And I would say this comprises the bulk of the kinds of interviews that you would be doing in any safety and accountability audit, where you want to go and talk with people who are doing the work on a day-to-day basis. So that means interviewing 911 call takers, dispatchers, patrol officers, visitation monitors, receptionists, oftentimes people who have that kind of gatekeeper role end up having a lot to say about who's coming through the door, who's trying to come through the door, the kinds of questions they have. It might include interviews with judges, court commissioners, advocates. It's going to depend very, very much on the question and the scope. And then finally, there's a type of interview that we've labeled the text-based interview. And that's to sit down with someone with a particular form in front of you and understand, how does this get filled out? How is it that if I call to make an appointment to come to a visitation center, or I call a protection order advocate to come in to get some help filling out a protection order, how is it that the form that you work with, that intake form, gets filled out? What's here? What isn't? Are there sections that get left off, never filled out? A text-based interview allows you to look more closely at those official administrative kind of procedures as they get carried out and transferred into forms, into a screen. Another example of a text-based interview might be to sit with a 911 dispatcher and really understand everything that's on that screen or the multiple screens in front of them, and to learn more not only about how they're doing their job, but how all of that gets set up in the form of that electronic format, what kind of documentation goes with it, what sort of guidelines and policies and tip sheets are they looking at as they're sitting in front of that bank of equipment. And I think this might be a good ID time to just kind of check in and see if anyone has any questions about this very basic approach to collecting data and building the kind of information that you're going to be analyzing. And the lines are open. Okay. I'm going to, in a couple minutes, I'll give you a couple of practice examples that I pulled out. Provide an overview from several communities about different approaches they took, the kinds of things that they looked at, so that if you're in that planning stage of thinking about how are we going to put all this together, you can kind of keep those in mind. And there are quite a few safety and accountability audit reports floating around out there now, and some of you may have already started to gather them up. But that's one way to get a sense of the range and scope and the kind of work that different communities have done that might help provide some suggestions to what you want to do in your own community. My observations, I've said a few things about those. I think those are sometimes the richest, well, I don't know, kind of a toss-up for me between the text analysis and the observations, which tends to kind of be the more exciting source of information. But it's such a significant way, this observing how things actually work in an everyday setting, for understanding both how we move different kinds of cases through a system and understand practitioners' work in context. Many times in different audits that we've been involved in, the response of the team members to getting some insight into each other's work has been one of the most valuable aspects of it. And it might be that someone in the patrol end of things has never actually gone and spent time in a 911 center. So they have no idea what that looks like, sounds like, the demands when someone's coming through and on the patrol end and asking for certain things, and how that has to get fit into all of the other work that's taking place within that, for that 911 call taker. Oftentimes advocates will come back and say, oh my God, I have never been on a ride-along before. I did not realize that this happens, or that it's a lot harder to make these decisions once you're there and on the scene. So those observations both give that insight into how work gets organized on a real everyday level, as well as that insight into each other's roles within this overall community-wide effort. The other thing that observations do is they also reinforce and give you an understanding of how people who become a case might experience something. For example, a protection order case. What that's like, really, when you step back and think about coming into a courthouse, trying to find out where to go to get the right forms, trying to walking into a hearing room for the first time, wondering where do I sit, can I talk, how do I find the advocate. You learn things by sitting there and paying attention and thinking about how all this works from the standpoint of somebody who's become a case. I'm thinking of one observation that I did a round of in a protection order court that was very busy, and there was a lot going on. It was very crowded, and the woman who was sitting next to me happened to turn to me and say, well, you know, I'm supposed to meet with an advocate, but I don't quite understand where they are or where I find them. So you, in those experiences, you start getting more insight into, well, what's this like for folks? Is it clear? Is it confusing? Does it feel safe? Does it feel protective? Does it feel vulnerable? Are you seeing everybody kind of milling together in the hall room and needing to walk within inches of each other, coming and going? There's all of this texture and depth to understanding what is happening, what the experiences are like, both for people doing the work and for those who are coming through the doors. One really fascinating example of this, and this is actually a bit of an example of text analysis that sort of crosses over into observation. In one of the audit communities we worked with, the court videotaped all of the proceedings in the protection order, and these were family court motions. And that was available to the audit team. So in addition to being able to sit in the courtroom and listen and observe and do an observation in that way, it was also possible then for audit team members to watch the DVD footage of those same proceedings. And it came from kind of two different vantage points. The observations sitting in the courtroom, you got much more of a feel of what that was like if you had come in carrying your orders and papers and petitions and wanting to address the court. Watching it on the DVD was seeing it almost more from the perspective of the bench, because that was the vantage point of the camera, unless the commissioner or the judge was speaking. So you got this, I think, insight into the demands on the decision makers of, first of all, many cases, piles of paper, trying to kind of wade through them to find out what was going on, seeing people come before them, some who were very prepared, some who had attorneys, some who were on their own, many actually, most on their own, and then trying to take into account what is the law saying about this, what our processes are in place. It was a fascinating look at this particular point in case processing for orders of protection from a couple of different vantage points. And that text analysis can take in things like videotape, computer screens, anything that sort of takes up some aspect of our experience and transfers it, puts it down in a way that it becomes official, that we get drawn up into the investigation of the case, the protection order application, a library card application. You can think of all sorts of different examples from everyday life where we run into documents and text. And in this case, in the context of an audit, you're always looking at this combination of things, interviews, observations, text analysis, that tie back into your question and the scope, which is going to really influence what you're taking a look at. And before I go on to talk about a couple of practice examples, any questions? I can share with everyone that I'm trying not to be way distracted by this giant flock of wild turkeys that's walking around outside the window I'm sitting in front of. Yes.
Dane, you know, through the years as I've talked to people about the different kinds of data collection, I've had people ask me occasionally, why do you need to do all three forms of data collection? Why can't you just go interview people, for example, or why can't you just go observe them? You
right.
have kind of touched on that, but I'm wondering if you could.
Well, it's very much that interconnection in the way one informs the other. And if you look at, if you take just one, if you take just interviews, a lot of times when we talk with someone about what we do, we tend to give kind of the official job description. This is what my job says I do. And it's not out of any maliciousness. It's just that it's a very kind of common way of answering questions about our work. If you get a chance to actually observe, then you get a lot more insight and think, oh, you know, here's, you know, there's this aspect of this job description, but I'm not seeing it here. So, for example, the job description might say that one of the responsibilities of the victim witness assistance person in a prosecutor's office is to make direct personal contact with every victim of domestic violence. And that things to those effect are fairly common in those kinds of job descriptions. When you observe, however, and get to spend some time with that person, you find out, well, that's pretty much an impossibility. There are multiple demands that aren't listed in the job description. That might be one thing that you notice. Maybe another attorney, one of the prosecutors, has said, well, you know, but I really need you to be spending some time reviewing these affidavits or some such thing. So you find out that there are other things that that worker has to do that aren't reflected in the job description. You get a sense of the scope of how many calls and cases are coming through. And you also get a feel for kind of the parameters of things. You know, saying that making direct contact with every victim of domestic violence within 24 hours, if there's one person in that position and they're working primarily, you know, say a 8-to-5 or 9-to-5 kind of job, that's probably not going to be happening very much. But with that observation, you get to see a lot more of what really happens. So in our interviews, we sometimes get that more official description. Observations give us a look at what really happens and the working conditions under which people are doing their jobs and making decisions. And then that third leg, the text analysis, is where we see how people's experience gets constructed as a case and how different pieces sometimes kind of fall off, so that when I'm thinking, for example, of the work that, this was a discussion that came up last week in conjunction with the Safe Haven Supervised Visitation Program, and one of the demonstration sites was talking about the text analysis that they did as part of their safety audit, and just realizing that it was looking at all of that stuff together and how much of it didn't get used and didn't have much meaning, and yet here they were taking all these notes and what was happening to it. It was that kind of recognition of all of the pieces coming together in this case file that they needed to step back and take a look at. How are we documenting? What implications does that have for safety? Do we even know why this woman and her children and this man came to the visitation in the center in the first place? So it's that intertwining of things. And then along with that, they did focus group interviews. They did interviews with advocates. They did interviews with parents using the center. They did observations of both what happened during an intake process. And all of that then contributed to that much richer understanding of what was really happening and going on. And I'll give, this would be a good point, I think, to give a couple examples of here of how different communities have organized this approach to collecting information and gathering the data in their safety audits. One thing I'll mention first, though, is that you can cover a lot of ground with a bit of advanced organization. So if you have, for example, a nice steady team of, say, six people, and each person does three interviews, each person does three observations, each team member reads three case files or listens to three 911 calls, whatever the scope of things in your audit is, that's a lot of information. That's actually more information than many PhD candidates have constructing their theses. So you don't need huge quantities, but you need enough to really kind of understand that this is the usual way of processing this type of case and organizing work to handle this type of case. But with, again, you know, each team member doing a few things multiplied and then contributing that cross kind of our expertise across different disciplines and professions, you get a very rich look at what's happening. So I'll give you just a rundown of a couple of practice examples here, and then see if we have any questions before wrapping up with some comments on debriefing and analysis. One of the audits that we've worked on and provided technical assistance to, again, this is one of the Safe Havens demonstration site projects as part of the supervised visitation program under the Office on Violence Against Women. And all of these reports, by the way, are available through the Praxis website if you want to look any further. But for each of them, I'll tell you what their audit question was, and then I'll give you a sense of how big their team was, and then the kinds of data collection they did. Because I think this will kind of help spark a look at the kinds of things you might want to be pulling together, or perhaps you have begun to pull together in your own communities. So in Kent, for example, they wanted to know, how does a victim of battering who might benefit from supervised visitation find out about it, decide whether or not to use it, effectively communicate that decision to the court, and find an appropriate visitation center. They had a local audit team of 6 members, including an audit coordinator, that represented staff at the visitation center, the Safe Havens funded center, someone from Family Court Services, and advocates from a couple of the different advocacy programs. And in this one, it was a little unusual because it was a demonstration site. There were also participants from the national technical assistance providers. So the whole audit team, 11 people. And for their data collection, what they did 3 focus groups with victims. They did a focus group with community advocates from, I think, maybe about 5 or 6 different organizations. So they really wanted to get that cross advocacy organization point of view there. They conducted 18 interviews and with different practitioners in the courts and in advocacy agencies. And that included, for example, court commissioners, judges, family court services, social workers, protection order advocates, community advocates, the person who is in charge of, it's a kind of a self-help law center within the regional justice center. All of those went into the interview mix. They did observations in the courthouse, both in person and via video footage, and it looked at electronic court records for protection orders. This was somewhat, it was very handy and perhaps somewhat unusual in that all of the protection order affidavits and other information for more recent cases was available electronically and could take a look at how requests related to visitation were represented in those protection order petitions or affidavits, and then in the final orders. They also looked at court forms, advocacy materials, websites. All of that went into the text analysis mix. And out of all this, one of the things they learned, among many, many different things about related to access to and knowledge of visitation services, was this both this richness of resources and this fragmentation, that when it all kind of settled out in looking at this, that access to information about supervised visitation was pretty confusing and haphazard for a person actually looking for, in need of it, who might benefit from it. And what they realized is that there were 23 different entry points, possible entry points, to supervised visitation and safe exchange in this whole web of community intervention. There was a lot of confusion about who was an advocate and what someone who had that title could do. On one of the protection order websites alone, there were 5 definitions for an advocate. And so it's an example of how all of that kind of information gathering then led to this one aspect and one conclusion that they reached in the scope of their audit. And again, there's many other findings and recommendations that are included in that report, and it's available online through the Praxis website. Then the other 2 examples I was going to give you are actually from the same community, and again, they have been gracious in sharing their reports with the wider world, and this comes from La Crosse, Wisconsin. And they have completed now, over a stretch of about 4 years, safety audit of their criminal case processing from 911 up through prosecution. And at 2 different times, 2 different audit teams, although there was some crossover, which is very helpful if you are looking at continuing or doing other, using this tool as a way to look at other aspects of your coordinated community response or other aspects of criminal or civil case processing in domestic violence cases, kind of carrying over this couple of team members from one audit to the other was very helpful because it provided a kind of anchor and platform to take advantage of. And in the first phase, the first phase included a 9-member team. And again, they did focus groups with victims of battering in the community, including a group with Hmong women. Lots of individual interviews, and a big chunk of these came in part from the audit coordinator, who was in a position to have the time and also quite, Casey and I were talking earlier, this can be a little bit of a watch out kind of quality in an audit, is that you can get so into just wanting to find out more and more and more that you can sometimes get a little carried away with reading maybe more case files or text than you need to, and sometimes talking with more people than you need to. Because in that first audit, there were a lot of interviews done. But the kinds of interviews, again, for some of you, these are going to be the sorts of people and practitioners you're going to want to talk with. Law enforcement officers, supervisors, community advocates, hospital social workers, 911 operators, officers and advocates involved in a specialized response team, probation officers. This first team then did rounds of observations. They did ride-alongs. They went to the 911 center. They spent time with staff in the Crime Victims Project, which was a kind of overarching look at all of the cases coming through the system. They went to some of the bail release and court appearances. And then included in their text analysis were emergency calls. These were available primarily in a digital format and then made available on a CD-ROM. They looked at patrol officer reports, incident reports from 6 different jurisdictions, policies, protocols, case processing forms, victim information packets. This was one of the realizations that came out of their audit, was that a victim of battering could potentially have contact with about 6 different interveners very quickly after a 911 call. And in the focus groups, there was a comment about, I know that this is meant to be helpful, but it can be really overwhelming to have this much contact coming this quickly after I've been beaten or my husband's been arrested. And I think in communities that have in place a pretty solid coordinated community response, might be one of the things that kind of emerges from the safety audit, is how do we then kind of shape that intervention so that it's most meaningful and not too overwhelming. And out of this pool of patrol reports and 911 calls, the whole team didn't look at everything, and the audit didn't include a detailed analysis of everything. There's kind of a level at which an audit coordinator gets involved in a broader look and is going to do more of that kind of analysis and then bring some of it to the team to take a look at. But in the end, across this countywide project, it looked in depth at about 20 law enforcement reports and about 13 911 calls. And I'm going to talk a little bit about their second phase, and then I'm going to kind of give you an example of, out of their analysis, some of the conclusions they reached. And one is going to be a fairly simple, this is, you know, pretty readily addressed. Two, this is more complex and it's going to take more time and more attention through our coordinated community response to deal with. But first, on the second audit, this was looking at the post-arrest to prosecution response in their community. And again, focus groups, individual interviews, and those included patrol officers, jailers, prosecutors, public defenders, victim witness coordinators, community advocates, clerks of courts, support staff in the DA, district attorney's office, folks doing bond evaluations, and supervisors in those related positions. And among their observations, and they did a lot of observations, this particular phase of their audit was pretty heavy on observations because in addition to looking at the jail intake and booking, they wanted to get a sense of the criminal case processing and prosecution across all of the circuit court judges in their respective courtrooms and hearings and be able to take a look at the process for pretrial release under all those courts. So across all of the audit team members, and there were 10 plus the audit coordinator, they did 87 observations over a period of about 6 months, I think it was, to take in that whole rotation. And then their text analysis piece, which included, as might be expected, things like prosecution files, the related domestic violence policies and protocols, the community corrections agency forms and case files, jail booking and release, bond sheets, the forms related to victim notification. And out of that pulled about 10 of the community corrections files and about 30 prosecution files to take a look at. So across those three audits, that gives you a pretty good picture of the kinds of different sources of data that went into their work. And again, kind of drawing on work that the audit coordinator did, different interviews and observations and documents that the team helped identify. And in both cases, these were audits that stretched out over a period of months. And before I take a break for a couple more questions, if you have any, I'll just highlight two of their findings because, again, I think this illustrates this range of some things that you learn are pretty straightforward to deal with and correct. Other things take a lot more work. So in the first audit, one of the gaps that they discovered was that some victims of battering received incomplete information about operating emergency cell phones. The process in place to provide emergency phones to victims of battering. In the course, and this started actually with an interview with the 911 person, they discovered that there's a lot of confusion about how phones worked, how they were registered and connected with the 911 center, and basically making them, in some cases, not as useful and as protective as intended. Now, that's a pretty ready gap to close. It can be addressed by providing some better instructions, doing some revised procedures and processes between the officers and the advocates who get involved in issuing the phones and the 911 center dispatchers that are involved in flagging those phones so that they know those are emergency phones assigned in that way. So pretty straightforward. In the second audit, one of the findings that came out of this mix of data collection was that aspects of courthouse and courtroom organization, environment and procedures diminish victim safety and offender accountability. And this came very much, it was very anchored in the observations and then supplemented by these other aspects of data collection. And that's often the case, I think, that you'll find that some of the conclusions you reach do kind of find their anchor more in one aspect of data collection than another. But again, you want to be complementing observations with interviews and reading case files or other documents. And if you're heavy on the document or case file end in supporting a particular finding, you also want to be talking with people about how that gets put together and seeing how that happens. So in this case, this gap, this finding around the whole aspects of courthouse and courtroom organization came out of largely the observations. And what the team members found as they began to spend time in the courtroom was seeing really how fast that moved, with little or no explanation of the decisions made. It was clear that people were walking away not really understanding what the conditions of release were. They found that there was no one who had a responsibility for explaining conditions of release to an offender or a victim. Many aspects of this gap and this finding, but that gives you a little flavor of some of what they learned. One of the things they found was that there was rarely a community-based advocate in the court with a victim who was asking to lift a no-contact order or other proceedings related to a domestic violence case. So there were a number of different aspects to this conclusion, to this finding, and that are much more complicated and will take a longer time to address than finding inadequate information around cell phones. One of their conclusions was that there should be a dedicated docket for hearing domestic violence cases rather than throwing them into the mix with everything else. Well, obviously that has many dimensions to it and requires a lot of discussion and linkage between all of the participating partners in their coordinated community response. Okay, question time. Any questions before we wrap up with a few comments about the debriefing and analysis point? And while I'm waiting, I'm going to take a drink of water.
And I'll just reiterate what Jane has said, which is that a lot of communities that have felt comfortable sharing the findings of their audits have allowed us to post their reports on our website. So under, and for those of you who haven't found your way to the safety audit section of our website, it's just praxisinternational.org, and then you click on safety audits. And there's a section called recent audits that goes into detail about some of the examples that Jane's talked about, in case you're interested. You can also call us and ask us questions about other audits, and we can connect you with these communities if you have, if you'd like to talk to them yourself.
And we've often, I know in audit trainings, in said it's a very brave thing for a community to open itself up, for
yeah.
an agency,
yeah.
for practitioners to open themselves up to this kind of scrutiny amongst their community partners and colleagues, and it is. And it's also, I think, a very brave thing then and very helpful to the wider discussion and attention to what do we do about battering and domestic violence for these communities to share their reports in such a public way and their work. So certainly appreciated. The last area that we're going to talk a bit about is, so you've gathered all this stuff up, and there is certainly this point where you feel like you are definitely at the top of that gigantic funnel, and it's whirling around with a lot of notes and thoughts and comments and questions, and how do you make sense of all of it? And we've kind of got some ideas there and some processes in place that are included in the handouts that go along with today's audio conference. But before, I want to say a couple of things about, well, how do you do this in a way that does not get people all defensive and totally outraged and say, wait a minute, this isn't what we agreed on, and we don't really think you found this, and what's going on here? Well, minimizing that kind of goes way back, and the tone gets set early, and it's really anchored in the kind of foundation and relationships that get built kind of early on, and crafting those memorandums of understanding and those expectations about how is this going to be shared and with whom, who's going to be involved, what kind of things will we look at, and that kind of foundation setting is important. It's also helpful to look at debriefing, meaning taking what you're beginning to see and hear and read and the questions and conclusions that are coming out of that, to do that in an ongoing way. And that's true, I think, whether it's a one-week blitz, in other words, you're making this huge push to gather all this information in a short period of time, or modified. Maybe you're taking a couple of weeks to do it, or a more extended kind of period of data collection for the safety audit. But to have a frequent way of bringing the team together, the team showing up, participating, laying out, here's what I noticed, here's what I wonder about, this has really got me going, gosh, how did that happen? Or that doesn't work the way I thought it did. But so keeping that debriefing going in a frequent way. That thinking and acting like an auditor, one of the previous sessions that you did, those eight ways that institutions organize work, those eight audit trails are really essential to framing analysis in a way that helps, again, kind of not make it the problem of a person, but really looking at how is it that this work has been organized in this way that contributes to this result. And so always kind of bringing something back to, well, is this something related to a rule or regulation? Is it some kind of concept we've got about what battering is that goes into the mix? And keeping that framework in mind. One of your handouts has an interview and observation top 10 tips, and that really applies to safety audits overall. And while they're all, of course, important, I think some of the key ones, both in terms of minimizing defensiveness and providing the foundation for sound analysis, is that you work with people you're interviewing and observing as a co-investigator, as someone who's teaching you what you don't know. And always kind of getting it out of your head, oh, I think I know how this works. And trying to, as much as possible, go into it. And this is harder in, for some of us, depending on our position in communities, than others. Suspending what you think you know. You just want to go, I want to find out what I don't know about how this process works, not what I already think I know. And if there's two bits of advice related to analysis and debriefing, above all, it would be stay concrete. You want good, clear, concrete examples of what you've learned. And that's related to kind of taking good notes along the way and developing good examples, and particularly of those debriefing sessions. Where you come together, you kind of lay out, okay, what are we learning here? What are we seeing? What are we hearing? What are we reading? And making sure you have a good record of that as you do that kind of debriefing. I would say if there is, if you don't take notes anyplace else, make sure that happens in those debriefing sessions. And then the other handouts we've provided kind of outline the steps in which you start to make sense of this. And it happens over a period of debriefings where it really, and this sounds maybe a little mystical woo-woo in a way, but it really does help take everything at the top of the funnel and start sorting it out. So you get concrete. You describe the interviews and the observations in the text. And out of that you say, well, I think this might be a problem. This might be a gap in safety. And then you try to articulate, well, why and how might that be a problem? And what's the evidence for that? Do you need more information? Do you need to go and interview someone else, observe something else? Do you need to read something else, find other forms or files or documents? And just exactly how is this a problem when we go and look at the way in which it's organized? Is it education and training? Is it resources? Is it our administrative practices? So always kind of staying concrete and applying that framework of analysis in the way that things are organized, and do that through the collective thinking of the audit team. And you'll find some things where you say, you know, we don't really know enough about this. We're not going to say that this is a gap or a problem, but we might say that this is an area where we need to learn more about, because we don't necessarily want to lose sight of that in our conclusions and recommendations. But this kind of steps and analysis that are laid out here really do provide, if you stick with them, a way of making sense of all of it. And I think we're probably at time, aren't we?
Yep, we are pretty close, Jane.
Yeah. Any question out there in our telephone land today? Well, keep in mind, you can always call on Casey.
Yep.
And Praxis.
Yep. And so thanks, everybody, for joining us today. I'll just remind you real quick to email us your evaluation forms or to fax them in. And this is the end of this series, but I'll remind all of you that we do have a real quick two-part series taking place next Tuesday and Thursday that's going to highlight, we're going to hear from audit coordinators, four different audit coordinators, two on Tuesday and two on Thursday, and they'll be talking about what came of their audit, so what they found, how they made changes, how they actually turned it into some kind of a concrete result for their community. So if you haven't registered for that or if you have questions about that, please feel free to give me a call. And otherwise, it was nice talking to you all. Thanks so much, Jane, for joining us. And we'll talk to you all soon.
Yep. Good luck to everyone. And I think I'd encourage everyone to tune in for those other calls.
Yeah, that'll be good.
The implementation ones. That's going to be really, that'll be fascinating.
It sounds really good. Casey, I'm going to be training with a couple of police officers, so I'm not going to be able to make that training.
Okay, that's fine.
But it sounds really, really great. I'm sitting over here making faces at the team.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that if there was anything in their schedule, so we'll look at that.
That sounds good.
Jane, thanks so very much.
Oh, you're welcome, and good luck, everyone.
Okay, thank you all. Bye.
Bye-bye.